grows in certain parts of the country is simply appalling. The American Pharmaceutical Association's Committee on the Acquirement of the Drug Habit had concluded in 1902. The New York Times published an article by a physician saying that the South was threatened by cocaine-crazed Negroes, to whom the drug had awarded expert marksmanship and an immunity to bullets, large enough to kill any game in America. Another physician, Hamilton Wright, the father of American narcotic law, reported to Congress that cocaine lent encouragement to the humbler ranks of the Negro population in the South. Should anyone doubt the implication of encouragement, Wright spelled it out. It has been authoritatively stated that cocaine is often the direct incentive to the crime of rape by the Negroes of the South and other sections of the country. The persistent and systematic notion that blacks were especially prone to crime extended even to the state's view of black leadership. J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI for nearly half a century, harassed three generations of leaders. In 1919, he attacked the black nationalist Marcus Garvey as the foremost radical among his race, then ruthlessly pursued Garvey into jail and deportation. In 1964, he attacked Martin Luther King Jr. as the most notorious liar in the country and hounded him, bugging his hotel rooms, his office, and his home until his death. Hoover declared the Black Panther Party to be the greatest threat to the internal security of the country and authorized a repressive, lethal campaign against its leaders that culminated in the assassination of Fred Hampton in December 1969. Today, Hoover is viewed unsympathetically as having good outside mainstream ideas of law and order. But Hoover's pursuit of King was known to both President Kennedy and President Johnson, King's ostensible allies. Moreover, Hoover was operating within an American tradition of criminalizing black leadership. In its time, the Underground Railroad was regarded by supporters of slavery as an interstate criminal enterprise devoted to the theft of property. Harriet Tubman, purloiner of many thousands of dollars in human bodies, was considered a bandit of the highest order. "I appear before you this evening as a thief and a robber," Frederick Douglass told his audiences. "I stole this head, these limbs, this body from my master and ran off with them." In Douglass's time, to stand up for black rights was to condone black criminality. The same was true in King's time. The same is true today. Appearing on Meet the Press to discuss the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, the former New York City mayor, Rudy Giuliani, in the fashion of many others, responded to black critics of law enforcement exactly as his forebearers would have. "How about you reduce crime? The white police officers wouldn't be there if you weren't killing each other 70 to 75% of the time." But even in Giuliani's hometown, the relationship between crime and policing is not as clear as the mayor would present it. After Giuliani became mayor in 1994, his police commissioner, William Bratton, prioritized a strategy of order maintenance in city policing. As executed by Bratton, this strategy relied on a policy of stop and frisk, whereby police officers could stop pedestrians on vague premises such as furtive movements, and then question them and search them for guns and drugs. Jeffrey Fagan, a Columbia University law professor, found that blacks and Hispanics were stopped significantly more often than whites, even after adjusting stop rates for the precinct crime rates and other social and economic factors predictive of police activity. Despite Giuliani's claim that aggressive policing is justified because blacks are killing each other, Fagan found that between 2004 and 2009, officers recovered weapons in less than 1% of all stops and recovered them more frequently from whites than from blacks. Yet, blacks were 14% more likely to be subjected to force. In 2013, the policy as carried out under Giuliani's successor, Michael Bloomberg, was ruled unconstitutional. If policing in New York under Giuliani and Bloomberg was crime prevention tainted by racist presumptions, in other areas of the country, ostensible crime prevention has mutated into little more than open pillage. When the Justice Department investigated the Ferguson Police Department in the wake of Michael Brown's death, it found a police force that disproportionately ticketed and arrested blacks and viewed them less as constituents to be protected than as potential offenders and sources of revenue. This was not because the police department was uniquely evil. It was because Ferguson was looking to make money. Ferguson's law enforcement practices are shaped by the city's focus on revenue rather than by public safety needs, the report concluded. These findings had been augured by the reporting of The Washington Post, which had found a few months earlier that some small, cash-strapped municipalities in the St. Louis suburbs were deriving 40% or more of their annual revenue from various fines for traffic violations, loud music, uncut grass, and wearing saggy pants, among other infractions. This was not public safety driving policy. It was law enforcement tasked with the job of municipal plunder. The reporter for the Washington Post deserves to be cited by name. Radley Balco, whose writing and reporting on the problems of modern policing have greatly improved my own understanding of the issue. It is patently true that black communities, home to a class of people regularly discriminated against and impoverished, have long suffered higher crime rates. The historian David M. Oshinsky notes in his book, Worse Than Slavery, Parchman Farm and the Ordeal of Jim Crow Justice, that from 1900 to 1930, African Americans in Mississippi comprised about 67% of the killers in Mississippi and 80% of the victims. As much as African Americans complained of violence perpetuated by white terrorists, the lack of legal protection from everyday neighbor-on-neighbor violence was never then and has never been far from their minds. Law-abiding Negroes point out that there are criminal and treacherous Negroes who secure immunity from punishment because they are fawning and submissive toward whites, observed the Nobel Prize-winning economist Gunnar Myrdal in his famous 1944 book about race in America, An American Dilemma, The Negro Problem, and Modern Democracy. Such persons are a danger to the Negro community. Leniency toward Negro defendants in cases involving crimes against other Negroes is thus actually a form of discrimination. Crime within the black community was primarily seen as a black problem, and became a societal problem mainly when it seemed to threaten the white population. Take the case of New Orleans between the World Wars, when, as Jeffrey S. Adler, a historian and criminologist at the University of Florida, has observed, an increase in the proportion of crimes committed by blacks, on the streets and in local shops and bars, as opposed to in black homes and neighborhoods, produced an enduring mix of fear and fury among whites. In response, Louisiana district attorneys promised that Negro slayers of Negroes will be thoroughly prosecuted. A common tool in homicide cases was to threaten black suspects with